For the Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson, with the latest readout video from our free Wednesday Wake Up email newsletter, to which you should subscribe, as well as watching these videos as avidly as they do in Hamilton, Ontario, number 35 on our all-time views list. And I also have something to say about the midsummer heatwave that apparently astounded journalists. The Economist's take was, quote, "The rise of the truly cruel summer. Deadly heat is increasingly the norm, not an exception to it," end quote. And the dateline on that piece was June 26th, 2024, on which the actual high in London, England, was 82 degrees Fahrenheit, or 27.7 degrees Celsius. And at time of writing, the high was 68 degrees Fahrenheit, or 20 degrees Celsius. So in one sense, yes, the summer has been brutal. It's been brutal for those who wanted all scorching all the time, and even proclaimed it ahead of time. As Climate Change Dispatch observed, despite a prediction of, quote, "summer of hell with almost complete certainty," end quote, in Europe, Germany actually had below average temperatures in June. It wasn't even hot everywhere in the United States, which AP made all about climate by saying, quote, "much of US braces for extreme weather, from southern heat wave to possible snow in the Rockies," end quote, and then spoke of a chaotic weather map. Atop a dogmatic climate one, in which everything, including rain in Florida, is due to you-know-what. Quote, "the damaging no-name storm system coincided with the early June start of hurricane season, which this year is forecast to be among the most active in recent memory, amid concerns that climate change is increasing storm intensity," end quote. Not that storm intensity is increasing, but who cares? Concerns are increasing. And the year of 2024 will stand out forever in human memory for the way that it got hot in midsummer everywhere except the places where it didn't. And another prominent peak among the hills on which climate alarmists are determined to die politically is forcing everyone to buy electric vehicles, or EVs, rather than internal combustion engine vehicles, ICEVs. And they're not getting anywhere because of a more general problem just expounded by University of Guelph economist Ross McKittrick in the Financial Post. Quote, "the fundamental problem is that EVs cost more to make and operate than most consumers are willing to pay," end quote. So, the government mandating EVs will actually drive up the price of conventional cars during the transition, making them more profitable, but not enough to save the auto sector from being forced to try to sell products people don't want. As McKittrick warns, quote, "if it takes a mandate to force consumers to choose EVs over ICEVs, the mandate will destroy the Canadian auto industry," end quote. Which is also true of Europe and the United States. So you will have nothing, and you'll be unemployed. Stinks, huh? As for the next big problem, China flooding our market with cheap EV imports, don't worry, government's on that too. Oh, wait, do worry. Because having mandated that we must all buy EVs, on learning that the Chinese are planning to sell them to us cheaply and put out of business all the money-losing EV factories that the government has subsidized in North America, the plan now is to abolish the cheap option with tariffs. Hey there. If you're one of the 40% of our viewers who aren't yet subscribed, please click this button and do it. Get us to 100,000. Thanks very much for watching, and back to me. And another thing. With a headline, quote, "almost half of US electric car owners want to switch back to gas-powered cars, survey shows," end quote, it wasn't a good week for EVs even before, quote, "a fire likely sparked by exploding lithium batteries swept through a manufacturing factory near South Korea's capital on Monday, killing 22 mostly Chinese migrant workers and injuring 8, officials said," end quote. Which the New York Times headline, quote, "deadly fire exposes harsh conditions migrant workers face in South Korea," end quote, which may well be true, but it also seemed to some of us to expose the tendency of EV batteries to explode, causing deadly fires, which seems to us important to the story. Ah, and with impeccable timing, National Geographic emails, quote, "Stonehenge, a mystery more popular than ever," end quote, and says, quote, "the mysterious megalith was built by a vanished people without a written language," end quote. Indeed. Or as Spinal Tap memorably put it, quote, "no one knows who they were or what they were doing," end quote. Which arguably could also be said of the activists who tried to turn it orange, not in tribute to Donald Trump, but because, we're all gonna die, or something. As the U.S. Oil and Gas Association sneered, quote, "nothing says just stop oil like vandalizing the ancient ceremonial site of Mesolithic hunter-gatherers who didn't use oil," end quote. Plus, as Stonehenge UK pointed out in urging a prison sentence for the vandals, quote, there are also multiple rare lichen species growing on the stones that are also protected, end quote. Yeah, it's part of that environment these activists keep hearing about. And here at CDN, we've offered a rival version of the alarmist's famous cherry-picked stripes graphic, showing what happens if you start at different points than the tendentious Little Ice Age, 1850. But, in the ecumenical spirit, we'd also like to point to Ron Davidson's take, which again uses various different starting points and also a wider range of hues to show the enormous natural changes and the fact that modern conditions are unusually cool, not unusually warm, by historical standards. Davidson offers considerable commentary as well, and many other features. So, enjoy his colorful trip through Earth's climate past. And, from the fake news file, courtesy of Blacklock's reporter, we learned that the much-touted Canadian government program to plant 2 billion trees to change the weather, already silly in a nation with some 300 billion of the things standing around tossing saplings this way and that, was fake anyway. An internal Department of Natural Resources memo explains that, quote, 2 billion trees was picked as an inspirational slogan and should not be taken literally. And, quote, the government sought a name that would inspire commitment and participation. So far that has worked, end quote. Yeah, worked, except in the sense of actually working. Quote, tree planting requires careful planning to ensure the right tree is planted in the right place at the right time for the right reasons, end quote. Whereas slogans just sprout like mushrooms after rain. Then, from the government and here to poison you sanctimoniously file, Canada's environment minister just banned compact fluorescent bulbs starting on December 31st, 2025 by regulatory fiat because, quote, it is crucial that we continue to protect the health of Canadians, end quote. Say, didn't the Canadian government force those same bulbs on us only two decades ago and misinform us? As in, quote, are compact fluorescent bulbs safe? Yes, they have a minute amount of mercury. If they break, they do not pose a health risk, end quote. And then it told us that if one did break, quote, remove people and pets from the room, ventilate the room for 15 minutes prior to starting cleanup, wear disposable gloves, do not use a vacuum to clean up the initial breakage as it will spread the mercury vapor and dust, end quote. As Arthur Dent once commented, it must be some strange use of the word safe that we hadn't previously encountered. But don't worry, thanks to government mandates, there probably aren't more than about 100 million of those bulbs in Canada, so what are you forcing on us next in the name of the environment? Flammable EVs? Energy poverty? Yes, indeed. And all perfectly safe, we assure you. Oh, and in the category of hallucinations by climate change zealots, we do have to give some kind of prize to, quote, America is losing the green tech race to China, end quote. This was a New York Times email teaser head on a piece by David Wallace Wells that did not disappoint when it came to goofiness. Quote, you have probably heard about the miraculous growth of green energy around the world in recent years, end quote, he says. Well, yes, we have. But we don't believe it, because we also know that alternative energy is heavily subsidized, that it piggybacks on conventional power sources, and is causing a lot of trouble to those who've invested heavily in it. If it's also a power grab by Beijing, we are not surprised, nor are we impressed. Meanwhile, a recent headline from The Australian reads, quote, blackout risks, a nation lost in energy transition, end quote. Oh dear. And what seems to be the problem? Quote, electricity users face a heightened risk of blackouts during peak demand in New South Wales and Victoria this summer, with the energy market operator forced to bid for emergency supplies amid delays in new transmission lines and renewables projects, end quote. But let's not pick on Oz. Every Western industrialized country is busy engineering blackouts and power shortages, and calling this process a stroll into the Emerald City of cheap, abundant, high-tech green energy does not take us to that other land of Oz. In the newsletter, we also continue our look at Professor Qingbin Liu's remarkable challenge to the notion of CO2 as the crucial man-made warming gas. He claims that the forcings from Halo GHGs are far more important, and by the way, forcings is how insiders refer to things that they think are forcing temperature upward, and that CO2 is far less so. As Liu notes, the Halo GHGs start leveling off after 2000 because of the Montreal Protocol limiting CFCs. And according to his CRE model, the slowing down and reversal of global warming as their influence wanes should occur first in high-latitude regions, that is to say, toward the poles. So, he compiled post-1965 land surface temperature and snow cover data from large areas in the Northern Hemisphere. And these two charts show, on the left, temperatures in the Northern Hemisphere regions outside the tropics, that is from 30 degrees north to 90 degrees north, excluding Russia and Alaska for reasons I'll explain, and on the right, they show temperatures in Canada, the contiguous USA, and Greenland. And yes, the leveling off after 2000 is clearly visible. Now, the reason for those omissions is that Liu argues in another paper that Russia and Alaska still show warming not because of greenhouse gases, but because of long coastlines, which means that they're experiencing the after effects of an interval of ice loss there. But inland Russia weather stations still show the leveling off. Northern Hemisphere and North American snow cover extent also fit the pattern. To the perplexity of alarmists long convinced that children won't know what snow is, after decreasing sharply from the 1960s through at least 1990, it's been increasing throughout the hemisphere, that's the left side graph, and in North America in particular, that's the right side graph. So, surely someone somewhere is curious about testing this remarkable theory. No? Well, if not, it could be explained by another series that we launched this week, a deep dive into a recent essay by climate scientist Patrick Brown on the incentives and the biases that are distorting modern climate science toward alarmism. Many of the issues will be familiar to CDN readers, but Brown is nevertheless uniquely positioned to expose them because he was the successful insider in the climate game who decided that he didn't want to play it anymore. In this piece, Brown presents a list of the 50 most widely discussed papers in climate science over the past 5 years. That's not necessarily the ones with the most academic citations. Instead, it's the highest ranked ones on something called the Altmetric system, which tracks mentions in news coverage and social media. Of these 50 papers, 3/4 appeared in only 4 journals: Nature, Science, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and The Lancet. Why those 4? In part because they, especially Nature and Science, have massive and sophisticated public relations departments that ensure widespread attention to the papers they publish, and the resulting media attention, in turn, supports the business model of the publishers. Brown's experience when publishing in Nature was typical. His work was covered by over 70 national and international media outlets. An earlier paper Brown also published in Nature was cited 4 times more than his next most prominent work. So, the difference is huge. Brown also cites evidence from other researchers about the career benefits of landing in a high-impact journal. So, these few journals really are gatekeepers to the golden groves of academy and their inner sanctum, tenure. But both Nature and Science have staked out very clear editorial positions in favor of climate alarmism and aggressive pursuit of goals like Paris and net zero, and they don't take kindly to submissions that they see as undermining those goals. Finally, in the newsletter, in honor of Canada Day, we delve into the CO2science.org archive for a summary of over 30 years of research on the benefits to sugar maples of having extra CO2 in the air. And it shows exactly what any sensible person would expect. So happy Dominion Day, all you trees. For the Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson, and I'm not surprised that it gets hot in summer, just like when I was a kid.
That's right.